Welcome to Zero Point Radio. This is Jim Moffitt for sitting in for Christopher Holmes with a message to Christopher Holmes, who is in New Zealand currently lecturing to the various Theosophical Society lodges in New Zealand, traveling around the country. Christopher, we're having trouble making contact with you from BBS Radio. If you could call 530-876-3222, that would be great, and we could patch you through. If you're out there, please try to contact Don at BBS. This is Zero Point Radio. As I say, our regular listeners will know that usually it's Christopher Holmes, Dr. Christopher Holmes, who begins the program. And my name is Jim Moffitt. I usually sit in with Chris as his co-host. And today I'm flying solo, so you have to bear with me a little bit here as I scramble wildly to try to pick up the threads here, because I wasn't really prepared to do the program myself. But as I say, we're having a little trouble contacting Christopher. I should just begin by telling you that every second week from 4 to 6 Eastern, North American Eastern Time, we've got a lot of time zones to cover here, 1 o'clock on the West Coast, Christopher presents what he calls his Zero Point Teaching, which is a complex model of consciousness which addresses issues in psychology and cosmology, spirituality, and virtually all and everything from this model, which is derived from mystical and esoteric teachings, but is also framed in a way that directed to create an integration of ideas from modern psychology and science. So a lot of Christopher's work deals with the most recent developments in modern physics and cosmology, as well as addressing the fundamental issue, the fundamental unresolved issue in psychology, which is the nature of human consciousness. And for the past 30 years, Christopher's been exploring these ideas, and I've worked with him in a variety of capacities, and we've studied these ideas and tried to bring them together in a increasingly more comprehensive and insightful perspective. And if you're interested in checking out Christopher's work, which I would urge you to check out, he has a website. It's www.zeropoint.ca. And Christopher has an institute that he founded with his wife, Anita Mitra. It's the Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Studies, and that's located in Cars, Ontario, which is outside of Ottawa. And his interest is in trying to create a dialogue between the ancient mystical and esoteric teachings, especially from the East, and the modern Western science. And in doing so, I think he's fashioned what is really quite a unique synthesis of these ideas. The last program, I spent some time talking about the early development of these ideas. Christopher was a PhD student at the University of Waterloo, studying to get his doctorate in clinical psychology. And during that time, he came into contact with the ideas of G.I. Gurdjieff, P.D. Uspensky, and the Fourth Way, and he began to study that material. And that was his real introduction into the entire mystical and esoteric tradition. And he based his doctoral dissertation on those ideas, applying them to the psychotherapy situation. And at the same time, I was a master's student at Carleton University in the psychology department there, and I incorporated some of the ideas from Christopher's thesis into my own thesis. And so we both, our entry into mystical and esoteric teachings was from a psychological perspective primarily, but as we got into the material more and more, we realized that this was a much broader foundation for psychology, insofar as that really the mystical and esoteric tradition deals with psychology not just in and of itself, but in relation to cosmology, in relation to spirituality, and really is a much more expansive and comprehensive perspective on psychology. So that really, when you talk about psychology from a mystical perspective, you're talking about the processes of the psyche, but you're also talking about the processes of higher dimensions and of the cosmos. And so, as a result of his dissertation and his introduction to Gurdjieff, Christopher began to develop was really what at that time was a fledgling model of consciousness from a mystical perspective, especially from the fourth way perspective. And right from the beginning, the two of us sort of recognized that there, if you treated the perspective that Gurdjieff was putting forth and tried to adopt it and apply it to modern ideas about psychology, there were a variety of moot points arose in terms of Western psychologists' approach to the study of consciousness. And the more we looked at it, the more we realized that this is a radically different approach to understanding consciousness, this fourth way teaching. And that it really dealt with the most fundamental issue which psychologists should deal with and which psychologists didn't deal with for 40 or 50 years and really have never undertaken in anything other than the most circumscribed terms. So psychologists study consciousness in a very, restricted perspective insofar as they tend to make a certain set of interlocking assumptions about how consciousness must be studied scientifically. And adopting the perspective of the fourth way led Christopher and I to understand that really we believe that this was truly, the fourth way was truly a much more scientific approach to the study of consciousness because it involved a systematic study of oneself. Psychologists always study consciousness in others. They study it by studying other human beings, by extrapolating from animal studies, but they never really study themselves, and they don't study themselves systematically. Now, one of the really interesting points, I think, that came out of the Gurdjieff teaching that Chris and I grasped immediately was the idea that you can't just sort of study consciousness in yourself in any old fashion, any way that you want. You have to have some sort of a system because you have to have some sort of way, some sort of a method, first of all, to observe yourself, and you have to have some sort of a system by which you can organize your observations. And the Gurdjieff teaching was, I think, particularly appealing to us because even though it was a very ancient teaching, Gurdjieff claimed that the fourth way had existed for thousands and thousands of years and that it had sort of disappeared for many thousands of years and that he had rediscovered it. And in doing so, his presentation of it, especially his initial presentation of it when he brought it to the West, was definitely addressed to the modern mind. So he attempted to frame things in a way that would be comprehensible to the post-technological age, and in a sense he adapted it to modern culture and to modern thinking. And one of the things that he really stressed was this idea that you can't just sort of study yourself willy-nilly, that you have to have this system. And his entire teaching was a way of not only of studying yourself, but also studying yourself in terms of a system which organized your observations, and this is critical. So that was one enormous distinction that Chris and I saw between Western psychology and Western academic psychology and this ancient esoteric teaching. So I went through sort of some of the basic elements in the last program that we began to identify in terms of studying consciousness, and the most basic thing that Gurdjieff says is that our normal waking consciousness is not really a waking state, but rather should be understood as a state of waking sleep or semi-hypnotic associative existence in which everything happens. Gurdjieff says that we're in our normal waking consciousness, we're under a spell of illusions. And the most fundamental of these illusions is that we're awake and properly conscious. And he says, not so. That really consciousness exists as potential in human beings, but it has to be developed. And in order for it to be developed, it has to be studied as it is. That is, the waking state, which is a waking sleep, has to be studied in itself. And then it has to be transformed. So this is a very... this is an idea that there's absolutely no parallel in modern psychology. Basically, modern psychologists subscribe to a very simplistic, that's my characterization of it, but I would say a very simplistic formulation whereby there are two states of consciousness. There's sleep and there's the waking state. And really, they don't draw any further distinctions than that. There's just the two states. And the problem with this is that it ignores, first of all, it just by that categorization. It ignores all those states of consciousness that people experience which lie outside the realm of normal waking consciousness, and that's a variety of experiences. And in general, I'd say that's one of the real big failings of the whole of the history of modern psychology, is that these states that they exist outside of the normal waking state are just sort of shunted aside and treated as if they're all, you know, they're anomalies, they're enigmas, they're mysteries, but they're not really relevant to the study of normal psychology, and I think that's a fundamental error. But the more basic point is that in characterizing just the two states of consciousness, sleep and the waking state, psychologists have missed the critical importance of being self-conscious or being aware of your consciousness in a fundamentally more comprehensive and intense state, which Gurdjieff characterizes as the state of self-conscious awareness. So I talked a little bit about Gurdjieff prescribes a method of observing yourself, but also of trying to remember yourself. And as I said in the last program, this is a very tricky concept, self-remembering, but it's very simple in a sense, too. You remember yourself when you're present, and all you have is the basic feeling, I am here. And it's in those moments that when you can remember, I am here, everything gets a little bit more vivid and more intense, and yet the problem is that we can't sustain that state. We think we can, but if you try to remember yourself, you'll find a couple of things. First of all, you'll find out that it's difficult to remember yourself, because you'll go about in your waking sleep and you'll say, oh, I'm going to remember myself, and hours will pass by and you'll do all sorts of things, all sorts of complex things, and then at one moment you'll wake up and you'll realize, oh yeah, I was going to try to remember myself and I've completely forgotten that aim. But even when you do try to remember yourself and are successful and have a moment where you're more present and you're more aware of yourself, I am here, what happens is that very imperceptibly you'll sink back into your sleep and consciousness will disappear. You'll go back into that state of semi-hypnotic associative existence in which you really don't exist. Like, there isn't an I present. Like, you're on automatic pilot. You're doing everything in the lowest state of waking consciousness, which is the state of waking sleep. And really, if you observe yourself throughout the course of the day, you would be able to see that there are moments when you're closer to consciousness and there are moments when you're farther away from consciousness. And then there are moments when you really are more conscious, and you'll realize that when you are in those moments, you can remember that you haven't been conscious for quite some time. And you can actually, if you go back, you can remember when you lost consciousness. You can judge exactly the moment when you thought you were conscious and then you just fell asleep and did a whole bunch of things. Uspensky, who was the most famous of Gurdjieff's pupils and wrote about him in Search of the Miraculous and wrote several books about the fourth way, describes that when he first was studying the idea of self-remembering, he was walking one day in St. Petersburg and he went into a tobacconist to get some cigarettes, and he was remembering himself at that moment. And then he describes that he bought the cigarettes and he walked home and he went inside to his apartment and he wrote several letters and he smoked and he had made some tea and he went through a whole series of process and he woke up about 3 hours later and realized he'd done all these activities and he'd been completely asleep. And that, I think, is when you begin to study yourself, that's the really great shock, is that you realize that, oh, you know, I really am not self-consciously aware most of the time. Most of the time I'm in the state of associative existence where everything happens and I am not present. I am not here. And in this, Gurdjieff says that we have all these little eyes that sort of come and go, and we have, we don't have any real consistent, continuous big eye, but rather we have all these little eyes, many of which lead quite separate lives from one another and which are even opposed to one another. And of course, everybody has some eyes that are stronger than others because we have certain interests and certain personality characteristics and temperaments and dispositions. But really, if you observe yourself continuously, you'll see that there really is no continuous I. The I is really just an abstract, and that in the sense that there's a continuity of the physical body, but there's not a continuity of the presence of I. So for Chris and I, when we started studying this, that this was a really great shock, and we realized that really most of, all of Western philosophy and psychology just don't really recognize this basic idea that we don't remember ourselves, that it's possible to remember ourselves, and that the effort of making making the effort to try to remember yourself introduces a whole new kind of understanding of the dynamics of consciousness. And Uspensky said something to the effect that real psychology begins when a person attempts to remember themselves and realizes that they can't do it, but that at the same time it's possible to do it, and that by making further efforts to do it, an entirely different change in the nature of oneself and one's consciousness occurs. And that's, he says, that's the beginning of real psychology. And I think really the experience that Chris and I had over the course of a period of about 3 to 5 years, I think, when we were first introduced to these ideas, really led us to this conclusion that Uspensky was right, that we had been introduced to real psychology, that the stuff that we were studying in Western academia, all of it was useful and all of it was relevant to a certain extent, but it was like the tale of the blind men and the elephants. Like, each of the parts of psychology is, each of the areas of psychology and each of the theories is the blind men touching parts of the elephant, but there's no central integration through a model of consciousness which really grasps the comprehensive nature of consciousness, that consciousness is related to everything, and it's not just consciousness is not just a division between the waking and the state and the sleeping state, that it's much more complicated than this, and that by studying yourself and by studying yourself systematically, by trying to change your consciousness, you come to an entirely different understanding of the nature of consciousness. You realize that it's much more complex than it's understood to be by Western psychologists, that it's much more dynamic than it's understood to be by Western psychologists, and that it leads to an entirely different understanding of the nature, not only oneself, but the nature of the universe. Now, fast-forwarding about 30 years, when Chris talks about his model, he talks about the perspective he's trying to put forward is that of that we are multidimensional beings. Human beings are multidimensional beings that exist in a multidimensional universe. And he means this quite literally. He means that that we have higher dimensions of consciousness and being within ourselves, which are dormant and which can be developed, which can be awakened. And that was Gurdjieff's aim, was to awaken these dormant realities within us, these dormant faculties of consciousness and awareness and being, and by doing so, to complete oneself as a human being. Like Gurdjieff says, like, we're human beings in the state of what he calls waking sleep, are unfinished worlds. And he says, by studying yourself and by attempting to awaken, that you complete yourself. And by completing yourself, by finishing your worlds, you have access to the higher dimensions of reality and the, you know, the traditional ideas of the higher being bodies, the astral, mental, and causal bodies, that's what the development of consciousness involves. And so that's what the perspective that Chris is putting forward is he's saying that we are multidimensional beings and that we are intimately tied to the cosmos, and that really what he's trying to do is explain that there's a very complex physics and metaphysics to human consciousness, which he relates to the human heart specifically, and says that that it's possible through the development and the opening of the heart to realize ourselves as these higher dimensional beings, or realize ourselves in these higher dimensions as higher dimensional beings, and to complete ourselves. And by doing so, we can gain access to these the higher dimensional realities and to experiencing union with the cosmos, which is the ultimate definition of mysticism, is to complete oneself, is to know oneself in unity with God or with the Absolute or whatever you want to call the essential underlying principle or force or intelligence that rules the cosmos. So what I'd like to do at this point is just to kind of go back a little bit again to this idea. It's like, it's very hard to kind of convey this as, like I say, Chris and I were studying graduate students in psychology, and Chris is really well on his way to becoming a very successful clinical psychologist. He was an outstanding student and really had his whole future looking very rosy, and then he discovered Gurdjieff and got interested in the fourth way. He got really quite obsessed with it in the best sense of obsession. But we shared this remarkable awakening to these things and to these esoteric and mystical teachings, which as graduate students we never heard about, which is really quite unbelievable. And the more we kind of study it, the more we talk to one another, the more we realize, geez, why doesn't anybody teach this in school? And each of us had tangential exposure to these ideas through school, but nobody had really ever made these like core ideas in the sense that said, you know, these are essential ideas about the nature of the self, and the nature of consciousness, the nature of being, the nature of psychology, and that we, as psychologists, we should all know about these things. We should all study mystical and esoteric teachings. And of course, as we began to pursue these ideas, we realized, well, the Gurdjieff system was the one that the fourth way teaching was the teaching we began with, but there was so much more to this that this was really just scratching the surface. There were all these other teachings that were really quite profound and quite elegant and quite remarkable in what they were saying about what the nature of consciousness and the nature of the self. And so we were quite shocked, and we started to try to interest other people, the fellow graduate students, faculty members in these ideas, and almost to a person, with a very few exceptions, Chris had a colleague, Paul Isaacs, who had actually, I think, been the person who had sort of directed him to read Uspensky's book In Search of the Miraculous. But and I knew a couple of people who were sort of interested in these ideas, but nobody seemed to really see the profound implications for these ideas about the nature of consciousness for everything in modern psychology and modern science. And so we were quite shocked, and at the same time, we were just animated by this the whole experience of discovering this. And it was a remarkable period of time for the next 2 or 3 years. It was like living in a state of grace. It was everything was filled with new meaning. Everything was exciting. Everything was new again. Everything could be, the meaning of everything could be seen in an entirely different way. Like once we began to understand that we were asleep and that it was possible to awaken from sleep and that self-remembering was very hard to do, but the more that we tried to remember ourselves, the more we tried to be present, the more we tried to remember our eye, the more we tried to observe how we were asleep, the more we studied ourselves as sleepwalkers, the more everything opened up to us, and the more we started to begin to see the possibilities of what it would mean to actually be properly conscious. And not that we were properly conscious by any stretch of the imagination. And that's kind of one of the things about the fourth way teaching specifically, is that it's a difficult system. It's certainly not for everybody, and that the whole mystical and esoteric tradition consists of a variety of teachings, because there are different teachings for different people. But it's a harsh teaching in some ways, but the harshness is the portrayal that Gurdjieff has puts forth of what human beings are. But at the same time, I never found it harsh in the sense that it just seemed real to me. But the other side of it is that it's profoundly inspiring and moving, in the sense that you begin to, as you study yourself and you begin to wake up in certain instances, you begin to see how incredibly powerful it is to be able to awaken, even in the briefest instances and even in the most mundane situations and circumstances. It changes everything. And so over a period of about, as I say, 3 to 5 years, Chris began to really try to bring some of these ideas together from the fourth way that he explored in his dissertation, and started to develop a model of consciousness. And in doing so, he he based his the model was based on the idea that the fundamental idea was the idea that you have to study yourself to study consciousness properly, and you have to study yourself systematically. And this is something, as I say, that psychologists study everything but themselves. They study rats and undergraduates and mental patients and undergraduates and rats and undergraduates. They study a lot of rats and a lot of undergraduates, but they don't study themselves. And this is a really huge failing in the whole approach of modern psychology. And there's a history to that at the in the latter part of the 19th century. There was a school of introspectionism where people tried to examine their consciousness and examine the contents of their consciousness and tried to develop a school of psychology based on that, but it never really went anywhere. And I would say that the main problem with that is because the people who were doing it didn't study themselves systematically. And so they didn't, so they observed a number of things, but they didn't really understand what they were observing. And that, again, reinforces Gurdjieff's notion that you have to study yourself in terms of a system. And they didn't understand the most basic thing, which is that when you study your consciousness, you introduce a change, in a sense, into it. When you try to be aware of yourself, you are aware of yourself, but that's not your normal state. So that's what Uspensky calls nature's trick, is that if you ask a person if they're conscious, they'll answer you that of course they're conscious because they hear and they understand you. And he said this is nature's little trick, in the sense that your question has momentarily made a person more conscious of themselves in that moment, but then the next moment that consciousness will fade back into a waking sleep, and the person will attribute that momentary moment of consciousness. They'll extrapolate and think that they're like that all the time, but they're not. They're not normally conscious at all. And I think that that's one of the real failings of introspectionism. So introspectionism sort of got discredited in modern psychology. People said, well, people did try to study themselves, and it didn't lead to anything. And I'd say, well, they did try, but they didn't try properly. And so then you have a very curious situation. You have these modern thinkers, these big minds and these so-called scientists, and then you have this entire tradition of esotericism and mysticism, which has existed for thousands of years throughout the world, and which people have studied themselves with the purpose of trying to develop and transform themselves. And so, really, I would agree with something that P.D. Uspensky said, which he said that really psychology is supposed to be a new science, that psychologists think that psychology was invented as a science in Wilhelm Wundt's laboratory in Germany in the 1870s, and Uspensky said, but really, there's a whole other psychology, and that makes psychology the oldest science, which is, it's always been part of the esoteric tradition, the tradition of studying oneself for the purpose of evolving, consciously evolving. And he said, in that sense, really, psychology is the oldest science, because every tradition within the mystical, every part of the mystical and esoteric tradition, whether it's alchemy or magic or occultism, all of these things have been involved with the idea that consciousness can be transformed and that people can evolve consciously, so that they, through their own efforts, they can develop consciousness, and that is an evolutionary process. So Uspensky says there's two psychologies. There's psychology in the modern sense, which takes human beings as they are, or more correctly, as psychologists imagine them to be. And then there's the ancient psychology, which is the psychology of self-transformation and self-realization. So that goes back to the whole yoga tradition, which is, 4,000 or 5,000 years old, in various types of Western hermeticism and, as I say, alchemy, the magical tradition, more recently in theosophy and occultism. These lines have run throughout the human history. And on that note, Uspensky says that really the esoteric tradition is hidden in modern thought. And that's sort of appropriate, because esotericism refers to the idea of hidden knowledge. But it's hidden in the sense that it's it's there, but people don't explore it. It's always available. You can walk into any bookstore and buy books about this, and they sell thousands of books about it. They do radio programs about it. But at the same time, if you don't make the effort to try to understand it, then you're not really going to know anything about it, and you're not really going to be familiar with it. And he says that most modern thinkers really don't understand the whole impact of the esoteric tradition that has run throughout human history. So he says you have the exoteric history, the outside history, the history of H.G. Wells and the more superficial, you know, this guy killed this guy in a battle and these ideas arose because of these technological changes. That's exoteric history. But then there's a whole esoteric history, which is a history, the continuous history of human beings' attempts to know themselves, the universe, and the gods. At the Delphic Oracle, over the Temple of Apollo, there was a famous inscription, and people know the first part about it. It says, "Man, know thyself." But the other part of it is, "And thou wilt know the universe and the gods." Now, Gurdjieff said that in one of his early talks that he made that he gave in Russia, he said, "Man," he began with those words, he said, "Man, know thyself." And he said, these words, which are known in modern times, have a much deeper and profound meaning than are generally supposed. And he continued by explicating the idea of what it means to know oneself and what it means to know the universe and the gods. This is the underlying principle which Christopher Holmes's work addresses. It says, how is it possible for this to be true? I mean, because I would say that this is one of the most profound statements in the history of humanity. Man, know thyself, and thou wilt know the universe and the gods. It's possible because these ideas express a fundamentally different notion of epistemology, which is the study of how we know, and of ontology, which is the study of the nature of what it means to be human, of human being. And the esoteric tradition says, again, that within ourselves, we have these faculties of consciousness and being which are dormant, but which can be developed by awakening, and when developed, can be further developed so that we can realize ourselves as multidimensional beings who are intimately tied to the cosmos in ways that we don't understand. And one of the most fascinating... Sorry, I just had a cat jump over me. It's always good in the middle of your presentation. I sort of lost my train of thought with that. I was trying to know myself, the universe, and the gods, and a cat distracted me, so that's how far I'm along. The idea is that one of the main things that Christopher Holmes has shown, which is really, I think, really astounding in this work, is that by examining ideas in modern physics, he ties some of the most astounding notions about the notion of the quantum vacuum and of hyperspace and the notion of zero points. He ties these concepts together with this ancient esoteric idea of knowing yourself, and he explains, he provides not only a model of how these things are connected on a variety of different levels, but he kind of has really taken, I think, what's a giant step in terms of giving a mechanism by which it's possible for people to transform themselves and exist in these higher dimensions, and by existing in these higher dimensions, know spiritual realities and experience union with the cosmos. Now, if you look at that idea from a skeptical, rational skeptical point of view, if you look at it from the point of view of the existing paradigm in modern science, which really emphasizes materialism and reductionism, that seems nonsensical. But really, that's the failing of that point of view, because if you really begin to look at these connections between the ancient esoteric teachings and modern science, and especially if you look at it through some of the mechanisms that Christopher spells out in his zero-point teaching, it's, to me, it seems really quite rational to suppose that it's possible for all these things, it's not only possible for these things to happen, for people to know themselves, the universe, and the gods, but it's even understandable on a certain level. Now, granted, when you're talking about somebody achieving union with God and the universe, a lot of that is beyond description and is beyond our understanding. But it is, we can provide maps as to some of the territory, like some of the features of the territory that are involved here, and some of the paths that are involved here. And I think, as I say, 30 years after reading about the significance of knowing yourself, the universe, and the gods, Chris is still working on this question, and I think he's providing a very increasingly more and more complex and comprehensive model of how this might happen. Now, in doing so, he's come a long way from just studying the fourth way. After studying the fourth way for several years, he began to be more and more interested in the idea of the nature of this whole idea that recurs in mystical literatures, that consciousness is light. And as he tried to understand this, he began to become really interested in the idea of higher being bodies. Now, Gurdjieff talks about higher being bodies, but he doesn't talk about them in great detail. He does say very profound things about them in different places in his work, but his emphasis is not so much on these higher being bodies. So Chris was more interested in getting a more in-depth understanding of what these higher being bodies are and what these higher dimensions were, like the astral, the mental, and the causal plane. And so he started to study theosophy, the teachings of Madame Blavatsky, and that was probably, I would think, in the early 80s that he began to get into that. And at the same time, he was, after he had graduated from the University of Waterloo, Chris went to York University in suburban Toronto, and he taught there from, I believe he started in 1978, 79, somewhere around that point. And when he was teaching at York, the Hare Krishnas, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, had ongoing workshops and teachings, and he made contact with some of the people there, and he started talking to them about Swami Prabhupada's work and became quite interested in his explication of consciousness, and especially like from that, one of the things that he really took was the idea that consciousness was related in the physical body to the flow of blood. And this really kind of turned, I think, some major lights on for Christopher in the sense that that was a development, something that he was trying to understand, which grew out of his dissatisfaction with the Western academic model of consciousness, and specifically with the idea that one of the things that Gurdjieff talks about, I talked in the last program, was the idea that we have within us not just a brain, but we have these distinct centers of intelligence which interact and which contribute to our consciousness. Our consciousness is the product of the interaction of these different brains within us. And he said, you know, we don't just have a brain in our head. He said that's what he calls the intellectual center, but we also have an emotional brain which is centered in the nerve plexus in the abdomen. And we have a moving and an instinctual brain, which is centered in the spinal column and in the lower brainstem. And as I said the last time, each of these centers of intelligence has its own way of knowing, its own way of its own speed of operation, its own type of memory. And each of these brains has a locus of concentration, a center of gravity. So your intellectual center is centered in your head brain. Your emotional center is centered in your abdomen, in your heart, and in your solar plexus, and your cardiac plexus, and in your gastrointestinal plexus. And then your moving center, which deals with learned movement, and your instinctual center, which deals with instinctual processes, is centered in the spinal column and in the lower brainstem, and in the sexual centers and in the sexual organs. And he said that typically in our waking sleep, we interact in terms of three centers. Like he puts the the intellectual center, the emotional center, and then what he calls the moving instinctual, but which is really the moving instinctual and sexual centers, the sort of the organism, the physical organism's center, puts them together and says that we interact intellectually, emotionally, and physically. Now, one of the things that came out of that, like as we began to study ourselves, Chris and I saw how this was really a much more satisfying model of how of the nature of human intelligence and consciousness, that we're not just, our consciousness is not just produced in our heads, in our brains, and that there are very good reasons for studying ourselves as interacting centers of intelligence between our heads, our hearts, and our spines. And so as a result of this dissatisfaction, he started to realize that this whole idea that it's the fundamental assumption in the Western approach to the study of consciousness is that consciousness consists of the that which is produced by the electrochemical processes in the physical brain. So consciousness is supposedly produced in the brain. But really, when you begin to look at that, you realize that even though everybody says that, everybody assumes that, there's really no definitive evidence which really indicates that. Stanislav Grof, who's famous for his holotropic breathing and a psychiatrist who's studied consciousness for the past 40 years and one of the leading lights in the transpersonal psychology movement, said this is the most fundamental epistemological ontological and epistemological assumption in the Western world, is that our brains produce consciousness. But really, nobody can pinpoint this. You know, people say things like, in, for instance, those who have listened to the program before know that Carl Sagan arises in our discussions frequently as the representative of the materialist reductionist approach, and he says in his books and in his Cosmos series that the cerebral cortex is where consciousness is produced, but there's no evidence for that. There's absolutely no evidence for that. You certainly can't be conscious without a brain. It's very useful to have one, but that doesn't mean that consciousness is produced by the brain. So this is one thing that Chris was really trying to understand, is like, how can we understand the idea that the entire physical body is an instrument of consciousness? Well, one of the most basic things, and this is what he got in his contact with the Hare Krishnas, is this idea that consciousness is associated with the flow of blood. And, you know, there are a variety of, it's quite a simple idea when you think of it, in a sense. It's like, if you observe in yourself the flow of blood, like what happens when you lie down in bed and you're lying on your arm, and you're restricting the blood flow to your arm, and you wake up and your arm has gone numb, or you have, you know, pins and needles. Well, you have reduced consciousness because you've cut off the flow of blood. If you get sexually excited, you have a flow of blood to your sexual organs, so you're centered more in your sexual center is your center of gravity because there's an increased flow of blood there. If you eat a heavy meal, you have that feeling in your stomach because you've got a lot of blood flow to help the digestive process. In modern neurology and studies of the brain, they monitor blood flow to try to figure out what areas are active in various processes in various tasks. So this idea, I mean, in a sense, it's a very simple idea, but it's a very profound idea too, and it's one that's really kind of overlooked in the Western approach to the modern scientific Western approach to the study of consciousness, is that this is a fundamental feature of consciousness. It's related to the blood flow. Now, from that, like Chris went on to further develop this idea of blood, and he talks about the blood of the subtle bodies, which is like the flow of substances which are akin to the blood, but on the subtle plane. So you have astral blood, and you have mental blood, and causal blood. And his understanding of consciousness was related to this idea, is that we can exist in these vehicles, these higher bodies, because they're somehow tied to the blood. So this is like a fundamental mystery that he was exploring, and this was just like the beginning. But it's such a basic idea, as I say, but at the same time, it's so overlooked within the modern study of consciousness. Like, for instance, when I say this, I'm not really exaggerating this, but I've spoken before on this program about there was a book put out a couple of years ago by Susan Blackmore, who's quite a well-known British psychologist, who at one point had a real interest in parapsychology and became quite a skeptic after her studies. And she has this book in which it's called Conversations on Consciousness, and it's the subtitle is something like Conversations with What the Best Minds Have to Say About the Nature of the Self and Consciousness or something. And most of the people that she talks to, there's a variety of scientists about consciousness, almost all of them, when you read this book, really just talk about the brain. And they talk about the brain in a very circumscribed, very fun, I would say, a very fundamental understanding of that. Well, the brain produces consciousness. At one point, one of the non-scientists that she talks to is John Searle, a very famous philosopher of consciousness. And at one point, Searle says, "Well, all we know for sure is that the brain causes every experience, every state of consciousness is produced by the brain. Every damn one of them, you know." And he goes on like this, and it's like, it sounds a little bit like a guy who kicks appliances when he gets mad with them or something. And it's like, well, you know, if I sound tough, I'll be closer to the truth about the matter. But the matter is really much more complicated than John Searle realizes, because, first of all, the brain doesn't produce consciousness. I mean, I don't know that, but based on esoteric and mystical teachings, I would say that it's highly dubious that the brain produces consciousness. And in fact, from the mystical and esoteric tradition, you get a very different understanding that consciousness is not something produced in your head. And consciousness is not really just the equivalent of the psychic functions, which is another basic assumption of Western science. Throughout this entire book of Blackmore, where she's talking to all these supposedly great minds, allegedly great minds, they just completely repeat these same things. Now, most of these people are neurologists and psychologists, so they've been trained to understand that consciousness is produced by the brain, and they don't really question that that's an assumption, and that's a real problem. But,
hi, Jim.
Yep.
Hi, it's Christopher.
Oh!
I finally got through. We had trouble with the phone. We've been trying for an hour for me to get through, and I ended up, I got through from New Zealand through the U.S. toll-free number.
Well, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. You've done very well. I've enjoyed listening.
Oh, well, okay.
It's been great. It's good.
Well, given the fact that I just got in about 15 minutes before the show began and I hadn't really prepared anything, I was just sort of winging it, so I'm glad you kind of came along. At least I got to take a drink of water, but...
That's funny. Yeah, because you were rushed to get back after traveling, and it's unfortunate you had to pick it up by yourself. But you really seem to pick it up, and probably it's better not to know ahead of time.
Maybe. Well, actually, I mean, this is partly material that I had. I'm sort of part of it's been winging it, but I had other material from the last time that I never really got to. But I was just sort of trying to move forward with this idea is to. You know, I talked about the profound implications of this idea of the what was inscribed at the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, that, you know, man, know thyself and thou wilt know the universe and the gods, and how that I think this is like one of the most profound statements in the history of humankind, and how, you know, 30 years later, your work has arrived at this point where you're really providing, I think, a model of not only how this could be true, but even providing specific ideas about the mechanisms of this that can be explored scientifically, and which are really quite consistent with what we're now learning from modern physics and cosmology. And so, you know, I was just reading material from your book the other day about the idea of non-locality and how physicists still kind of cling to this idea that it's impossible, where it's clearly been shown that, you know, non-locality is a reality, So it's like...
Yeah, Nick Herbert.
Says
the quantum reality is a fact.
Yeah, and yet it's like scientists know this, but they don't want to sort of accept the implications. But that has such profound meaning for the idea that a human being, by knowing themselves, could know the universe and the gods. Like, I mean, it's actually provides an understanding of the universe, which makes it much more intelligible to understand how you could know yourself in the universe of the gods if we're multidimensional beings in a multidimensional universe, which on some level is non-local. Then everything is at some point on some level inside of everything else. So that the idea is that if you could go deep enough inside yourself and know yourself so profoundly, you would know not only yourself but the universe and the gods, because there, on some level, there isn't anywhere to go, right? Like where everything kind of collapses into a singlet.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's interesting. I mean, it's like what Blavatsky says, that there's one omniscience which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe.
Yeah.
So that's a traditional concept of God, being omniscient.
Yeah, yeah.
Meaning that in some way, mysterious way, all the knowledge and information of the universe is present at every point.
Yeah.
So that implies that there's a point within ourself, and this is associated, as I'm trying to articulate in my work, with the higher dimensional physics of the human heart.
Yeah.
And we can go through the Upanishads and Yogananda and these other mystical accounts where people experience cosmic consciousness, and it is said that the outer world is somehow all contained within the mysteries of the heart.
Yeah.
Another quote from Blavatsky from The Secret Doctrine, she says, deity is within every point. So I'm saying a human being has such a zero-point condition. And actually that's associated with the higher dimensional physics of the heart.
Wow.
Yeah, so the entanglement, see, that's another way my work differs from other work, like Dean Radin, for instance. He's written this popular book called Entangled Minds. But people in the new science think the entanglement between people is more connected to the mind. And I would agree that there can be entanglement through the mind, but the deeper entanglement is through the higher dimensions of the heart.
Yeah, when you say...
In the Upanishads, one quote says, the earth, the moon, the stars, all that is in the outer world is within the lotus of the heart.
Yeah. You know, entangled minds, that you mean and by association, like entangled brains, eh? Because does Radin kind of, in that book, that he subscribes to, like, sort of the head doctrine that the brain is the mind is associated with the brain is
yes, basically, yes.
Yeah.
That's the problem with Radin's book. Like, I do a review of it on my website.
Yeah.
A very complimentary review, but then I argue that that's the limitation of his work, that he sees the entanglement as only having to do with the mind and the head. Even though some of his research showing entanglement effects is actually research that monitors heartbeat and heart effects.
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, like I had read his previous book and which is really interesting, where he reviews the entire body of parapsychological research and says that, you know, if you apply that he really provides a really compelling statistical argument for the reality of what's been found about the realities of parapsychology in the laboratory. He says, you know, the skeptics who say that, well, you know, these aren't proven. He said, if you take all of the material together and do sort of a mega statistical analysis, that the evidence is overwhelming as to the reality of parapsychology. It's not like, you know, it's not even in doubt. It's just so beyond, you know, being questioned.
That's excellent in his book. As you
yeah.
say, he does meta-analyses of different areas of parapsychological
yeah.
research. And the odds are like billions
yeah.
to one.
Yeah,
normal psychological research is accepted as significant. if you reach a probability level of 0.05.
Yeah, 95%.
100.
Yeah.
That's accepted as significant. And
yeah.
Yet the parapsychologists come up with odds at like 1 in a billion.
Yeah, yeah.
And still scientists, you know, the professional naysaying skeptics, they dismiss it out of hand, pretending to be scientists, but really simply being pseudoscientists, dogmatists.
Yeah, I just realized a couple of things. First of all, just on that, you know, we had this discussion with when Odin was on before too, and about Laszlo's work. And again, a very, very interesting work. Like, I really like his work, but I would say that he subscribes to the head doctrine. And then, like, Ken Wilber too, who's really kind of probably the foremost modern scholar of consciousness who really does incorporate the mystical and esoteric traditions, but he subscribes to the head doctrine. I don't see any kind of indication in his work that I'm aware of, and I certainly haven't read all of his books. He's got a lot of books, but you know, I read several of his books, and he subscribes to it. But I wanted to just kind of finish something because
That for a moment.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's what's astonishing about my book, The Heart Doctrine.
I do too.
Is anything comparable to it in existing modern literature?
Yeah,
and it shows this heart doctrine. It's in Christianity, Judaism, Kabbalah, Islam, and Sufism. The secret doctrine of Kabbalah, like that, is a core esoteric teaching in all the different real traditions of occult knowledge.
Well, it's
and
funny.
That's simply been no one grasps it. No,
well, it's funny too.
Seriously,
it's funny too because I've said this before on this show, and I'll say it again. It's like when you first started writing about this, you know, about the heart doctrine, and you started providing examples, and you were building this manuscript, and you were building and building, and you were showing it to me, and I was working on it with you and giving you feedback. And at one point, I said to you, you know, like there's so many examples, you kind of need to cut down on the number of quotations, because I was so overwhelmed by how many different people say this from so many different traditions. It's there in all these traditions. And you know, this is, and yet people don't recognize it. This is what I was trying to get when I asked Odin several programs ago, you know, if he knew of anybody else whose work paralleled yours. And he brought up the names of, well, he mentioned Laszlo, and well, he mentioned Friedhof Capra, and I mean,
yeah, neither of those at all.
Well, neither.
I haven't read Laszlo.
Well, what I was trying to do, I was trying to set it up so they'd say no, but he said yeah. You know, we didn't really get into it. But see, I disagree with them in the sense that I don't know of any other work which is even close to yours in terms of putting out this idea, first of all, of the heart doctrine, and then beyond the heart doctrine, this whole idea of the zero point as a portal between dimensions and as a fundamentally different way of trying to understand the nature of consciousness. And I don't see that in anybody's work. And part of it,
yep.
Again, this is the other piece I was going to try to tie in to bring it back to what I was talking about when you came on the air, was in Susan Blackmore's book. And this is, I found the... when I read these people, it seems to me, whenever they're talking about consciousness, they sound like these disembodied beings. Like they sound like they just live in their heads, and that, you know, really, I don't know, their bodies are sort of there to get them around town and to feed themselves and have sex. But it's like they're cut off from their bodies. Like Rupert Sheldrake uses the phrase disembodied beings. I thought I was the one that came up with that, but I may have stolen it from Rupert Sheldrake, but they very much do sound like disembodied beings. Whereas you're saying that your consciousness arises in your heart and it illuminates the psychic functions, and that, you know, it's not produced in your brain, which is a fundamentally different idea, radically different conceptualization of consciousness from anything that I know of in modern science or psychology.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the heart doctrine is radically different. The concept of consciousness connected to the blood flow.
Yeah.
I've never heard anyone mention that, even though when they try to show consciousness in the brain,
they measure blood.
Monitoring blood flow.
I know.
But everybody, it's amazing. It's amazing once you begin to grasp the heart doctrine. You begin to see it in all the esoteric literature. and more clearly you see the dogma of the head doctrine.
Yeah.
Like just how everybody assumes that, but which for which there is absolutely no scientific evidence. But they think there is. You know,
yeah.
They have what they call promissory science. Like, we don't understand consciousness yet, but we know it's just a matter of figuring out how it's produced by the brain. So they make that assumption that it's produced by the brain. And so it's fundamentally mistaken.
Yeah, and has such...
And then, as you say, the other thing was, then I came to this concept of that human beings actually have zero-point centers ourselves as living beings, based on Blavatsky's secret doctrine. Now, although there's a lot of writing in the new science, like Lynn McTaggart writes about zero-point fields and the whole new kind of discussion of zero-point fields, no one grasped the idea that human beings actually have such a dynamic zero-point center ourselves within the heart. So they understand the idea of zero-point fields, but not the idea that a human being actually has a zero-point center. So again, I think my work is really quite remarkable and revolutionary in the framework of ideas I've proposed.
And entirely...
Not to say even that I know that it's true, even though it's confirmed by my own self-experiences as well as I can discern. But it's a model, and it's a theoretical model that's worthy of scientific investigation and examination, and you know, it's a model of consciousness. You can think out the implications of it and draw hypotheses from it, and there's a way of approaching it scientifically and philosophically if we're clever enough and understand it. So it's not just an irrational idea. It deserves to be given consideration from an academic, scientific, philosophical viewpoint.
Yeah, and at the beginning of the program, you know, I began by saying that really psychologists subscribe to this very simplistic notion of consciousness that there's two states, we're either asleep or we're awake, you know, and I made mention of the fact that really there are all these anomalous, enigmatic, mysterious states of consciousness that people have that just get sort of shunted to the side and don't really get addressed, and even those people, I didn't say this at the time, but I would say even those people who recognize these as experiences as being worthy of examination don't seem to see how they relate in any way to the normal waking state or to you know, the normal psychic functions. But I would say that from your model, what your model provides is a way of understanding these very anomalous, enigmatic, and mysterious experiences, and brings them into a much more comprehensive perspective. Like, there's a way of understanding the dynamics that are involved here, which really escapes. You know, the only real explanation is that there's something wrong with people's chemistry, but really, that's, you know, in some cases, that's true. Like, there may be biochemical aspects to it, but that's not the complete picture by any stretch of the imagination. It certainly doesn't address the mystical experiences that people try to develop. You know, I mean, it may have something to do with.
I mean, I would even expect there to be biophysical.
Well, there should be. Yeah, exactly.
And I'm saying there is actual physics to it.
Yeah.
The kind of physics underlies the chemistry, underlies the biophysics or biochemistry.
Yeah. You know, another thing that, I don't know if you heard when I was just before you came on, I was talking about the influence of the Prabhupada's ideas about consciousness, the blood, and I mean, it's interesting how like basic ideas like that can lead to. We talked about this in a previous program, but I mean, it's certainly worth always returning to. Is like this idea of when we read Paramahansa Yogananda's autobiography of a yogi and his description of his experience of cosmic consciousness, which is really one of the most profound. I mean, you could read 17,000 rat studies and you'd never get anything as important as you get out of this in terms of trying to understand what this happened to this guy and what he's describing. Eh? And even for us with a background in esotericism, it's taken us years and years to get a more and more comprehensive understanding of what he's describing. And I mean, obviously, the best way to understand it would be to have the same experience. But, I mean, there's so many different elements to it. Like, and that's one of the things I find so interesting about this whole attempt to try to study this scientifically, and to try to articulate a model is that these things take on new levels of meaning the more you study them, the more you learn, which is really anything but the fulfilling the stereotype of those who subscribe to mystical and esoteric ideas as being people who don't have the wherewithal intellectually, you know, to study science and study physics. I mean,
yeah. A couple of points I'll pick up on what you're saying. One first point is that I would argue that the model of consciousness I suggest, it related to the heart and related to blood flow in the body, is actually substantiated by a huge wealth of clinical data and self-experience if you begin to study consciousness in yourself.
Yep.
And examples of this, like I play the pointing game. I get people to point to the ceiling and your left foot and the wall, and then I say point to yourself. And almost the vast majority of people point towards their heart area to indicate self. Whereas really, if our consciousness and self is manufactured by the brain up in the head, you would think people would be pointing to the head. But hardly anyone ever does that.
Yeah.
So another example I use is where I get people to put their hands together and see if they're the same size. And then I get them to separate their hands and put their consciousness into one of their hands for 15 seconds. And then you put your hands back together and you found that the hand you put your consciousness into grows about a quarter of an inch. Mine does. Because when I put my consciousness in my hand, the blood flows there. Now, there's no way to explain that in terms of the head model of what consciousness is.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We don't have cortical control of vascular activity.
Yeah.
And then there's other instances, you know, you eat a big meal and it feels like your consciousness is in your stomach. And I would say, yes, that experience of your firsthand experiential data actually substantiates this model of consciousness connected to blood flow. It corresponds with our own inner experience if we consider it. Whereas the scientists, no one responds to my work. I mean, you know, everybody just ignores my work. You know, I've not seen anyone within the scientific community ever consider any of the things I say. You know, they just saw that this is such a rigid kind of dogma. You know, not that I've published professionally for people to be exposed to it, but...
You know, there's a guy, I wanted to just mention this guy to you very briefly, but I meant to mention this to you before, but there's a guy named John Sarno who has a book called Healing Back Pain, and his central idea is that most back pain is caused by emotional problems which restrict blood flow into the musculature in your back and the soft tissues, and he says it's almost without fail. He has a whole program for healing back pain. That people's back pain is correlated with their emotional states and with the flow of the blood. And it's funny because I've had a history of I've had actually fairly serious trauma to my neck and lower back playing hockey, and I have. Really, you know, I had bad time with back pain and everything, but I've noticed since reading his book how this is very true of me. One of the examples he gives is that they have studied people who don't have back pain and had them x-rayed and had their backs examined and found that people have all sorts of, degenerative disc problems and all sorts of problems that should be causing them massive back pain. They don't have any back pain.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously if you have damage to your back, that may lead to back pain, but it's not simply a matter, even something like that. Like, a friend of mine who's a doctor said, 100 years ago, people didn't have back pain.
Yeah.
You know, it's a relatively recent phenomenon, and he relates it, I think it was very convincingly, he relates it to blood flow, you know, that it's an emotional constriction of blood flow.
Yeah, which also suggests that if you have pain in your body, see, normally if people have pain in their body, they contract and they hold their breath and they try to restrict their consciousness of that pain. Whereas what I would suggest to people in pain management is try to go into the pain and experiencing it consciously and to be breathing deeply and feeling into the pain.
Yeah.
So that would then enhance the blood flow to that part of the body instead of trying to constrict it, which people do to cut off the sensation of the pain. So instead we want to kind of do the opposite. We want to go into kind of deep breath and bring our consciousness to where we feel pain.
Yeah.
But just to come back, I started to say about how self-hand and experiential data support this concept of consciousness connected to the heart and the blood. And then you had mentioned Yogananda. I want to bring it back to that.
Right.
You mentioned his experience but didn't really recount for our listeners what it involved.
Yeah.
He was sitting in an ashram, and his teacher, Sri Yukteswar, he says to Yogananda, he says, this is quoting from Autobiography of a Yogi, he says, "Poor boy, mountains cannot give you what you want." Master spoke caressingly, comfortingly. His calm gaze was unfathomable. "Your heart's desire shall be fulfilled." Sri Yukteswar seldom indulged in riddles. I was bewildered. He struck me gently on my chest above the heart. So he, by striking Yogananda gently on the chest above the heart, somehow he awakens Yogananda within the heart. And then from there, Yogananda says, "My body became immovably rooted. Breath was drawn out of my lungs as if by some huge magnet. Soul and mind instantly lost their physical bondage and streamed like a fluid piercing light from my every pore." And then what he describes is a succession of states of expanded awareness. First, where he's in a state of samadhi, such that he experiences the whole ashram and things around him from a simultaneously all-perspective perspective. So he's not seeing these things around him from one perspective, but it's as if he's interpenetrating the whole volume of space around him. And then his consciousness begins to expand to embrace, let me pick it up here. Well, it expands, and he embraces larger, he goes to experience the Earth, and then the solar system, and the galaxies, and then he says, "Sextillion galaxies blaze within the infinitude of my being." And so his consciousness expands into this cosmic proportion. And then he says in here, "I cognized the center of the Empyrean, with the Empyrean is the seventh heaven, is regarded as the highest heaven, as a point of intuitive perception in my heart. Irradiating splendor issued from my nucleus to every part of the universal structure." So he's saying that he has a nucleus, meaning a center point, related to the Empyrean. It's this kind of highest spiritual nature, and he connects it to the heart. Okay, so there's another example. Like, that is a first-hand account of his experience, okay? So, again, that is data, like scientific data. It doesn't mean it's true, but that at least is his experience. So, in modern, you know, of course, a modern skeptic naysayer would just say, "Oh, well, it's, you know, probably, you know, he's on drugs, or he, you know, a knock to the brain, or this or that other explanation."
But the
they would, sorry?
The, but I was just going to say, but the other side to all this, too, is that, you know, that when you were describing the beginning, what he was talking to his master about, what he was complaining about, was he wanted to have an experience of samadhi, of like the selflessness and union with the higher structure, and then his master struck him over the chest. But he was a yogi, and he had been training for several years practicing yoga and practicing these disciplines, because with a normal person, my understanding is you couldn't do that with a normal person. Like, give them that, even a master couldn't strike you over the heart, and you couldn't have that experience, because you wouldn't be capable of taking that kind of, you know, that that kind of power through you, you wouldn't be able to awaken like that in an instant. Like, you'd have to be prepared to a certain extent. So, like, he's kind of done this ongoing experiment on himself for many, many years to get to this point where he can even have this experience. So, like, I mean, yeah, as you say, a skeptic would say, well, you know, he took drugs, or it's like, oh, it's some sort of, you know, experience in his brain, but it's not in his brain. It's an intuitive point of perception in his heart, which irradiates splendor, which it sounds very much like the God, which, you know, thrills through every atom of creation. Eh? Like, on some level, it, like, there's a union, there's a resonance there, this intuitive point in his heart with God, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's the perfect holographic model.
Yeah, exactly.
The holography is that any part embodies the whole.
Yeah.
Now, so that part within us is related to this higher dimensional physics of the heart. That is the part that embodies the whole of the universe. So it's like you were describing earlier, it's like the more our consciousness resolves into the depths of our heart, the more our consciousness can be expanded into the world around us. Whereas the heart opens, it's like your consciousness is less and less confined simply in your mind, in your head, or even in your physical self. But it is a perfect example of holography, that we have this, the point within the heart is it exists within this field of omniscience, of all-knowingness, of all the kind of knowledge of the universe. And so we do have access to such higher dimensional realms. And as you say, that's not something a person can easily attain, or in a way you wouldn't even want to. It's as Gurdjieff described, you know, if you awoke a man who wasn't prepared, he would go mad.
He'd go crazy, yeah.
Yeah, and he couldn't integrate it and come back and live a normal life. Like when Gopi Krishna opened his brow chakra and he couldn't function for months and years, and you know, his mind was so into the nether world and psychical realms.
Yeah.
You know. So a person doesn't really want that. So what's most important is trying to cultivate this awareness of the heart and learning to live in the heart. And the heart's so interesting, because one of the most interesting ideas about the heart in mysticism is this concept of there being a form of nothingness at the heart of being. And this is really profound, this concept of nothingness. And I'd like to explain this a little bit. Like, consider as an example to illustrate what I mean. Consider the space around you and the room around you. Now, what is the color of space? Okay, well, space doesn't have a color. Does it have a smell? Can you touch it? No, in a way, space is a form of nothingness. Okay, so you can't see the space. The space is like nothing, but because there is space, you can be aware of all the things, the walls and the people and the flowers. And so it's because of the nothingness, the presence of the nothingness, allows you to be aware of all the things. Now, similarly, the origins of consciousness within the heart, I would say there's this form of nothingness within the heart. And it's because there's that nothingness that you then can be aware of all the things.
Yeah.
The thoughts, the feelings, the sensations. So consciousness, it's like when you try to understand consciousness, it's like trying to understand it's a form of nothingness. It's not a thing. Like, psychologists kind of talk about consciousness as, oh, it's a thing. But in a way, it's a form of no-thing.
Yeah.
A form of no-thingness, which allows you then to be aware of things. And so if you are aware in the deepest level of the nothingness at the heart of being, then your consciousness can expand to embrace the universe, because all the knowledge of the universe is latent within that no-thingness. So the concept of, like, I think the idea, understand consciousness, understanding it as a form of nothingness or a no-thingness, and then the idea of light, consciousness is like light, which illuminates things. So that's why Aleister Crowley, for instance, he represents consciousness as a point within the circle. So the point represents the point source of light, and it exists within a space, and the space is the emptiness. So I argue in my writing, we each have this kind of point source of light, a divine spark. Shirley MacLaine calls it a God spark. Blavatsky calls it a monad. The Vedas call it a Jiva Atma. So there's a point of supernal light or fire, and that exists within a vacated space. And the light of the self within the vacated space is like the basis for the physics of higher consciousness. Yeah, and I'm saying these ideas, see, a lot of people think these ideas are just meant metaphorically.
Yeah.
They think everything is, oh, well, that's just a metaphor. Like if I say, you know, you got to develop heart consciousness. And they go, oh, well, that's just a metaphor for, like, being nice or being kind or being loving. And they don't realize, like, no, I'm not saying just that. I'm saying that this has a higher dimensional physics to it. It's not analogy. It's not myth. This is the substantive reality to these claims.
That's why at the beginning when I said, you know, people think man know thyself, you know, thou wilt know the universe and the gods. I'm saying that's not meant metaphorically. That's meant to be. That's literally true.
Absolutely. Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
All of these things. When people say, you know, people who don't have an understanding of this, they'll say, oh, you know, he's one with the universe, and you know, one with the universe, and they go, ha ha, and they think that that's, you know, some sort of hippy dippy. Kind of imaginary self-aggrandizement, but people can be one with the universe, and it's like a very profound idea, and it's really out of ignorance, and people projecting their own ignorance onto things when they try to dismiss this as being, you know. Now, some people use these terms too. That's the problem, is that, oh, you know, one with the universe, but they don't really kind of grasp what they're talking about too, so that's the other side of it. But when you really get to the essence of these things, these are very profound. Well, the profound doesn't even do it justice. These are the most remarkable maxims about the nature of what it means to be a human being. I mean, you can take all the things like as above, so below. A man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, you know. Know thyself.
Meaning, eh?
Yeah, these all have profound. Man is first one, or God is first one, then three, then seven. You know, I mean, all these things have embody worlds, basically, in just a few words. It's really remarkable. With the more you study these things, the more you realize, wow, this is so incredibly profound.
Yeah, and it's so incredible because as you begin to grasp the ideas, it's like learning the keys to unlock the mysteries of different esoteric traditions, because there's certain things that are common.
Yeah,
and if you grasp the idea of the heart, the idea of the zero point centers, consciousness is light, these key ideas, then it provides you with what you need to understand different esoteric literature. I just found a quote here I wanted to read.
Sure.
From Mohammed. This is he says, "I who cannot be fit into universes upon universes, fit into the heart of the sincere believer." So
wow.
There again is that concept
of
this God within us is somehow contained within the heart.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really contained within the heart. That's from our perspective. Really, the heart is contained within it.
But, you know, again,
the sense of it.
It was funny because, you know, I was talking about, you know, your interest in the higher dimensions and the subtle being bodies and leading to the idea of the blood, you know, at the same time. I remember, like, in the early 80s, we had, through Gurdjieff, when he compares consciousness to light, and he talks about, you know, that we're like broken machines that operate in the dark, and the idea is to be more conscious, is to throw more light so that things can function more efficiently and more properly, you know. And the more we sort of looked at this idea of consciousness as light, the more we started to understand, well, it's not just meant metaphorically, it's also meant like consciousness is light in some sense. And then we sort of, it's like, well, it's like, it's, you know, the electromagnetic perspective, spectrum. But then we kind of realized, well, no, but then from the Yogananda experiences, also related to the idea of like the supernal light, and there are higher dimensions, there's this light. Like the idea of consciousness and light recurs throughout all the mystical and esoteric and religious literature, and it recurs through people's experiences, both those who try to acquire the experience of higher consciousness and those to whom it happens spontaneously. And now with the modern technology, with more and more experiences, near-death experiences, you know, recurs in that. Like, it, you know, it, the, as you say, when you take all these things together, the evidence for the idea that consciousness is light is overwhelming. So then the task becomes, well, how do we understand it? And that's where, like, in the early 80s, we started to read about, Ken Wilber brought that book out, The Holographic Paradigm, and Marilyn Ferguson and the Brain Mind Bulletin. We're talking about the ideas of Carl Priebram, neurologist, and David Bohm, a physicist, on the idea of the holographic universe. And that, I think, is one of the really critical theoretical developments, which, as you say, you were alluding to earlier, you know, Yogananda's experience of the idea of knowing yourself as an intuitive point of perception in the heart, it all ties in perfectly with the holographic ideas. Although even the ideas that Priebram developed, you kind of take that a little bit further and, you know, criticize his kind of understanding in some ways, and Bohm too, like, it all ties together. It's like it's the perfect kind of model to provide an explanation for all these things that we misunderstand and all the things that we can understand. It brings them all together into a certain perspective.
Yeah, it does. It provides keys. Like, that was my critique of, like, the holographic paradigm in psychology emerged in the mid-80s, but it kind of died out and didn't go too far, except being used as a metaphor. Like, everybody knows the idea that we're parts of the whole now. But in the holographic paradigm, no one ever considered seriously the idea that there is actually an inner light source, which is projecting the holographs of our life. Like, they had the holographic paradigm, but Priebram once said, well, there are no laser beams in the brain.
Yeah,
I mean, he assumes, first of all, that the basis for the holographic system would be in the brain, rather than taking the whole human being, because the center of a whole human being as a quantum system, okay, is the heart, because the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 5,000 times the electromagnetic volume of the brain.
Is it 5 or heart. Is it 50?
No, I thought it was 5,000.
Oh, I thought it was 50, but okay. But it's a lot.
But
it's a lot more powerful than the brain. Yeah.
Yeah. So if we look at it scientifically, then the heart is the center of the human being. But coming back to the holography, they had the holographic paradigm, but no one ever considered, well, maybe there is a divine spark, which is described as inherently self-illuminating within the higher dimensional physics of the heart. No one ever considered such an idea. So they had the holographic paradigm, but no one had any laser light. Like, to produce a hologram, you have to have a laser, and you have to have a point source of coherent light to produce a hologram. So they had the holographic paradigm, but no one considered that, well, a human being might have a point source of supernal light within them. And then, so that's what, again, I think my work provides a key to taking the holographic paradigm further.
But yeah, when I was
Talbot's book and Priebram and other people, no one's considered that there might be an inner light source within the human being.
Yeah, and I think that's partly because, as you say, people are locked into the head doctrine and assuming that. That's why when I was talking earlier, I said, you know, that everybody assumes the head doctrine, which is that consciousness is produced by the brain, even though there's real no compelling evidence for that. In fact, you know, the more you look at it, the more you realize that it's sort of preposterous to even say that or to even assume that. However, you know, it's understandable in the sense, but because, you know, we think, well, where does consciousness arise? And we think it arises in our brains. But the other side of it is, in your perspective, is you're suggesting that there's couple of parts to it. First of all, it's like that this light is stepped down from higher dimensions within us, manifests through a spark in the heart, and illuminates the psychic functions of the brain. So in a very real sense, it is very much akin to the reference beam in holography. Like, it's a laser, so it's a source of coherent light. That's what a laser is a source of coherent light. So you have this source of coherent light, which arises in the heart, and which ties in beautifully with the idea of the mystery of how the heartbeat starts in the human being, which is not really understood. And then it like in mystical teachings that consistently talk about like the heart is like the sun. It's the source of light, and the mind is like the moon. It's illuminated, but it's illuminated by reflecting the light which originates in the sun. And so that's a wholly different type of model to explain the nature of consciousness. Is that consciousness really, I mean, consciousness is, it's within us, but it's without us, like, it's higher dimensional, eh? Like, it originates and it's stepped down within us and arises in us on a certain level. So the idea of consciously evolving is to try to overcome the sources of darkness and constriction, and to open ourselves and awaken ourselves so that by becoming more coherent in our current state, we can gain access to the higher dimensional aspects of our nature and the higher dimensions that one can know through being conscious in the higher dimensions of our nature.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then, like,
yeah, so I mean, even you look at, and then you begin to see it. I mean, it's in even in our language. I mean, we talk about being enlightened. Okay,
yeah.
Well, enlightened. Okay, light. And when you have experiences of enlightenment, you feel illuminated. You experience this inner light. And it can illuminate, like I might have an experience of illumination, and that, for instance, and I might be aware of a whole pattern of my life extended in time. And it's like that whole pattern of my life is illuminated at one time simultaneously. It's like the more light there is, the more the patterns of your life and such can be illuminated simultaneously. And how normally people live in outer darkness. I mean, it's in the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, and Christ says, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, people in modern times think that the eye that is single is the eye in the third eye. But no, I would say this is the eye of the heart. And you see that picture in my writing where it shows like that heart that opens up into an eye, and it has two wings out the side, which represent the level aspects of the mind.
Yeah, I've talked about this a little bit before in the program too, but there's that incredible speech that Aldous Huxley gave about the visionary experience and light, you know, and he talks about the experience of light in that people have had throughout the ages. I mean, he talks about both people who have tried to acquire light. I mean, St. Paul on the road to Damascus was blinded by the light. Plotinus had these experiences where he was filled with light. All these great mystics have these. Yogananda describes, you know, he saw the universe as God's body was tissues of light, he says in that description of his cosmic consciousness. And again, you have these experiences from people, the great mystics describing light. But then he's talking about all these other experiences where people have experiences of light. And he said, you know, there are many spontaneous experiences where people have described. He describes this one woman, this English woman, who was making tea in the kitchen one day, and all of a sudden, the whole room that she was standing in was like filled with this, like this magnificent light, and she felt herself kind of overwhelmed by this light, and it just spontaneously happened to her. And she said that from that experience, she developed a belief in the essential all-rightness of the universe. And he says this is a common element that people get this idea of the essential all-rightness of the universe, and they lose their fear of death. She says she lost her fear of death as a result of this experience. And it's like, I always say, like I bring this up, is like, you know, imagine if some therapist was able to develop a program where people would lose their fear of death and develop a sense of the all-rightness of the universe. I mean, boy, that would be pretty impressive. But, you know, because it's an experience of light, it's something that we can't really understand in our normal way of understanding things. But there's some intelligence associated with light, which is the higher intelligence associated with light, which recurs and recurs and recurs. And it's not like, it's not a coincidence. I mean, it's so consistent that you have to try to understand this. You know, what does this mean? How could this mean? And yet, you know, again, bring it back to the holography. It works in so beautifully. It's so consistent and resonant with the idea of holography, but like, you know, coherent sources of light
exactly.
Illuminate. Oh, I think we... Sorry, I lost somebody there.
I just opened my book, The Heart Doctrine, to the chapter on consciousness, light of the self.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to just read a couple quotes here just to kind of show this idea in different sources. The first one is from Sri Chinmoy, apparently, who has just passed away the last couple weeks.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I just heard that yesterday. He says, God is an infinite consciousness. He is also the self-illuminating light. There is no human being who does not have within him this infinite consciousness and this self-illuminating light. In the innermost recesses of his heart is his real I, his God. In the spiritual life, the thing that is most needed is the awareness of consciousness. Without it, everything is a barren desert. It is our consciousness that is self-revealing in everything.
Wow.
Okay, and then a quote from, here we'll take, from the Upanishads. It says, the light that shines above the heavens and above this world, the light that shines in the highest world beyond which there are no others, that is the light that shines in the heart of men. And here's from the, this is from Nickel, writing a student of Uspensky and Gurdjieff. He says, what we seek above all things is light, and light means consciousness. We seek to live more consciously and to become more conscious. We live in darkness owing to the lack of light, the light of consciousness, and we seek in this work light on ourselves. And it is very strange, this light. In the deep sleep we live in the light of the kingdom of heaven, we are all utterly insane and do not know what we are doing. And if you look at the life of contemporary humanity, you see this, that people have, in a way, on a political level, like people have become utterly insane.
Yeah.
The mind, the delusions of the mind. Here from the Dialogue of the Savior. This is from the Nag Hammadi Christ Library. This is supposed to be Christ speaking. Christ says, the lamp of the body is the mind. As long as you are upright of heart, well, I'll come back to that term, being upright of heart, then your bodies are light. As long as your mind is darkness, your light, which you wait for, will not be. The Lord said, when you remove envy from you, then you will clothe yourself with the light and enter into the bridal chamber. And the last one from the Pista Sophia, again, Christ is instructing his disciple. He says, seek ye all the light, that the power of the stars which is in you may live. For God shall save their soul from all matters, and the city shall be prepared in the light, and all the souls who are saved will dwell in that city and will inherit it. So again, it's just taking seriously this concept of consciousness as light, and that's, just, again, it's a scientific hypothesis. You see, it's not meant simply metaphorically. It's, you know, light is a physical phenomena, but it's also a metaphysical phenomena.
Yeah.
But this is a scientific idea. it doesn't prove it's right. But what you see, if you look at the evidences of people's first-hand experiences, there's overwhelming evidences that people experience states of inner light and illumination and enlightenment. So how do we account for this instead of just, oh, it's brain chemicals or lack of oxygen?
Yeah.
You know, so we need to take these ideas seriously and then try to understand the model of the universe which can incorporate an understanding of cosmic consciousness, past life reviews, and all these phenomena. And that's what I've attempted to do in my work, is to develop an actual model of physics and metaphysics that allows us to understand expanded states of consciousness, afterlife existence, and so on and so on. That's, I guess, you know, it was like 25 years ago when I began studying the parapsychology research, and I thought, oh, I might try to do some parapsychology research. And I started investigating it, and I thought, there's no need to do parapsychology research. There's already overwhelming evidence for ESP, ghosts, out-of-body experiences. All these phenomena have been, you know, studied by many, many scientists who have been, like, sincere scientists who tried to be rigorous in their examination of these issues. I said, you know, we're only trying to prove it for the kind of skeptic naysayers who can deny anything beyond their cerebral cortex.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm not even going to bother with that, you know, and I've had my own experiences through life. So I didn't want to try to do other parapsychology research to prove ESP exists because the evidence is already there. So let's take the next step. Okay, these phenomena exist. Get used to it. Get over it. You know? So let's
get over
now
yourself.
Consider, how does it work? How can we develop the higher faculties of the spiritual soul within the human being?
Yeah,
and just as a last thing, just to bring it back to something you were saying, I think this ties into, you mentioned Gurdjieff's idea of us as having higher being bodies.
Yeah.
And this is so important. Like, in a way, it's said in the mystical literature, everybody has this eternal principle, this jiva atma or monadic essence within them. So everyone has a spark of that holiness within ourselves. But Gurdjieff says, in a way, we have to attain our soul. So if we don't develop our higher being bodies, our astral and mental bodies, then we don't embody that spark. And it is so removed from us. It is so removed from us that we can't experience it. Thus, in a way, it's so profoundly important that we have to strive to attain our soul. And that means we have to work on developing our higher being body. See, I think in a way religion has weakened people by kind of saying, oh, don't worry about it. Everybody has this eternal principle and we'll all go to heaven and you'll live happily ever after.
Yeah, I completely
agree. Well, I don't think that's true.
I completely agree. I think that, you know, it's like they've given up the instrumental aspect of religious teaching and just think it's like, well, if you just go to church and put money in the collection plate, everything will be fine, you know?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It's
I like what you two says. The God I believe in isn't short of cash.
Yeah.
That's what you two say. I love that.
You know, there's a quote from Isaac Newton, who, of course, in addition to, you know, being maybe the greatest scientist who ever lived, was also an alchemist and studied the magical tradition very intensely. And he said, why may not nature change light into bodies and bodies into light?
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know,
I noticed we're coming down. We only have 5 minutes. And I did have a couple things I really wanted to bring up. So I'm gonna,
go ahead.
First was, I had a most remarkable coincidence. I don't know if you've looked at my website lately. But I was sent this email this week, and this is a news item, okay? It's from spaceweather.com. And the title, Exploding Comet. The core of comet 17P Holmes erupted on October 23rd, at first the comet looked like a dimensionless point of light in the night sky.
But
now the comet's disk is visible to the naked eye, reports Doug Zumanel of Kansas. The expansion of the debris cloud is shown in this doublet of images taken October 25th and 26th by amateur astronomer Wall of Hong Kong using an 8-inch telescope. Then it reads on, what is happening to Comet Holmes? It remains a mystery, one that you can behold with your naked eyes. Step outside after sunset, face north, and look for the glowing and fuzzy star in the thigh of Perseus sky map. Comet Holmes is similar in brightness to the stars of the Big Dipper. Very easy to see.
Wow.
This was actually a news item. And I put the picture of this on my website, on the home page, just under the little point within a dark circle that I use as my home button on my website.
Yeah.
And you look at my home button, and then you look at the picture of this Comet Holmes that erupted, this kind of sensational cometary thing that's happened last week, and they look exactly the same. It was so funny for me.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, because coming down to New Zealand, you know, it was like a breakthrough for me, and the seminars went so well there, and now I've been invited by the TS to tour New Zealand, and we have about 6 more engagements at the moment, and we're still doing more. So it's that was just a very funny and fortuitous concurrence of atoms.
Yeah, I'm looking at your fortuitous concurrence on your website.
Yeah.
That's
and
great.
Then it was like 17P Holmes.
Yeah.
So my middle initial is
P. Yeah, I know.
And 17, to me, is like a 1 and a 7.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Is like the law that I teach all the time.
Yeah,
the law of 7.
Yeah.
And the 1 is like... Yeah, that gives you 8, which is the law of the octave. So the 1 and the 7 is like the octave, and then P Holmes.
That's so funny.
The erupting comet, I identified with that. I put that up on my website.
Wow.
I would encourage people to have a look at that. It's quite fun. I don't know what to make of it all.
At www.zeropoint.ca.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Wow, that's pretty
amazing. So peculiar.
Yeah.
Also, just a last couple notes. Boy, I'm very worried about what's going on in the States. I just pray for the people of the States. Be strong. Like what's happening in the States with this new supposedly anti-terrorist legislation is just another step towards the imposition of a police state. I'm just very fearful of things to come.
Yeah.
And just ask people in the States, you guys, you men and women, you be brave, and we all try to face this monster together. You know, the truth has come out so much, it's coming out all around the world. People are beginning to wake up and see the monstrous things that have been done in our society. You know, God save America.
Yeah.
You know, you people support Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, or Mike Gravel. These men have integrity, and they're trying to stand forth on the world stage. In Canada, Connie Fogel. You know, we need people upright of heart to kind of stand up and try to support each other in facing the monster upon us. I think we're really in very severe and kind of critical times, and we don't want to sink into the fear of that, but we need to recognize that the severity of the situation. And yeah, the more you realize that you can't let it go, it becomes, you know, a driving force. And there were major developments in the States this week. Ron Paul was on Jay Leno. The mainstream media is beginning, they're having to let him in a little bit because everybody realized what pathological lies they did to us.
Yeah.
That was interesting. And Alex Jones released his new Endgame movie. You can watch it on videogoogle.com. It's a shocking movie, an expose of the Bilderbergs and the kind of criminality of the elites on our planet. So, you know, we all have to be brave and try to face the monster of the time. And we will get through this and bring about a new world. And we have to be upright of heart. The heart in most people is turned downwards. They're controlled by money, sex, and power. That's all they care about. We have to awaken in the heart, learn to experience love, and then we can attain to the higher faculties of the spirit and soul. Okay, sorry, I just needed to get those things in. We're kind of winding up here. Thanks for carrying it from the show, Jim.
Oh, yeah.
Please, I was listening in as Don and I were trying to make contact here. We'll be back in 2 weeks. I had a guest for today, but it didn't work out, and hopefully we'll have him back.
Okay.
Thanks, Don, BBS Radio, Jim Moffat. This is Christopher Holmes. Please visit my website. Someone buy my books. They're interesting books, profound books. And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Thanks, BBS.
Okay, thanks. Goodbye.
Bye now.